You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked-about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host. And with me today is my dear friend, Cindy M. Lott, Esquire, who is an associate professor of professional practice at Columbia University and also serves as academic program director for nonprofit management program at the School of Professional Studies. She teaches several courses addressing governance, ethics, management, and the relationship of the nonprofit sector and government. Prior to her current position, she served as executive director and senior counsel to the National State Attorneys General Program at Columbia Law School, and within that program was the developer and lead counsel to the Charities Regulation and Oversight Project. So we're going to talk with Cindy today about educating the nonprofit sector and specifically our leaders or people who are coming into the sector to be leaders. This is really important because our sector is expanding. The number of organizations continues to grow, and we need people managing organizations who frankly know what they're doing. And one of the ways people can go about becoming educated is to engage in nonprofit management programs. But of course, this isn't the only way. We're going to talk about options that people have for getting educated. And we're also going to talk about the importance of education for our sector, a sector that developed largely because people had the heart for the work and not necessarily the skills. And it is this newly formed educational component to our sector that is really important right now, I think. And so we'll get a chance to talk with Cindy about that. We're also going to talk about her career and the work she's done with state charity regulators to get them the information and insight they need to do their work well. Cindy, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, and thanks for joining me.
Absolutely. Glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Cindy, you and I have been doing this for some time, although people don't tend to give you a lot of credit for the amount of time you've done something these days. But I think one of the most important things that you and I have been involved in is educating young people and sometimes not so young people in the work of the nonprofit sector. When I started out in the sector years ago, there were very few programs that were designed at the collegiate and graduate level to educate people in nonprofit management. They were probably, you know, programs that were in business and you might take a class in nonprofit management or you might take some workshops here and there, but there were very few, you know, programs that were dedicated to nonprofit management and leadership. And Columbia has developed this program that you now lead. And I want to say you've done a wonderful job putting it all together. What was it that sort of led you to this work? I know you'd been doing some other work with Columbia, but what was it that led you to getting involved in education and particularly building a program like this at Columbia?
Let's see. How far would you like me to go back? And thank you for that intro. I always want to thank all of our faculty at this program in particular. But Art, it's been a pleasure having you as a faculty member. And we go back to also working together on the when I was on the board of the Wise Giving Alliance. So it's all been part and parcel of our relationship together. I had been thinking a lot about this, and when we think about professionalization of the nonprofit sector for some time, and as with most really interesting career opportunities that I have had. This was a serendipitous one in terms of the specific MS degree, the master's program at the School of Professional Studies at Columbia University. I had been at the law school where I was running the National State Attorneys General program, my colleague Jim Tierney, and I had been doing years of trainings for the regulators, the actual charities regulators, which is completely a form of education funded by various foundations. And it was very much putting together small curricula, if you will, for all of the different programs and topics that we were dealing with. And I went over to talk to someone at the School of Professional Studies. They invited me because they had a very specific issue around charities regulation, believe it or not. And they happened to mention that they were looking to try to start a master's degree in nonprofit management. They already had one in fundraising management and they wanted to convert it. So they were in the process of thinking about how to deal with the state of New York for accreditation, et cetera. And I discussed with them the fact that in my non-existent spare time over the years, because I had taught at other schools as an adjunct in both law schools and one class in a policy school, that I had developed what I called a model syllabus of thinking about how we would teach nonprofit issues, whether it was being deployed in a school of business, a policy school, or a law school. It was a new one on me to think about the school, a school of professional studies, which is a different animal, but it turns out it was a very, very good place to do this because it sits at the intersection of trying to have research to practice and practice to research, which is what has been of interest to me ever since I was at Yale Law School, even before then, about how to be practical, but also be elevated in your thinking and sophisticated in the way you analyze situations and try to figure out solutions to some of our most pressing community needs, social needs. So I jumped at the chance when they said, well, would you like to take a crack at this? And they actually gave me almost scarily too much or a lot of free rein. And I designed the entire curriculum, but I did a lot of research before I did. And my hat is off to those schools and different educational institutions that have had these types of programs over the years. Many of them very regional or for a very specific geographical area, but they gave a good source of guidance in thinking about what might work and what might not work at a university like Columbia, located in New York City with a large international population in particular. So after doing a lot of research around it, we were supposed to have about 2 years to launch this entire new curriculum, and it's a full curriculum. I wanted to birth a whole and full baby here. And so we had 9 core classes and a lot of electives, more than most schools and most programs that we have in our school. And we wound up launching the program after only a year. And we've been flying that plane and building parts of it ever since. And I've been very fortunate to have such great faculty that have come in, such as you and other folks that I've known and that we had on faculty already. So with that, we've taken off, and this will be our 5th year of teaching the curriculum.
Well, it's been an absolute joy for me. I've been with you now, I guess, about 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you the quality of our students, the way they engage in every class and every discussion, the diversity of our student body is quite stunning also. I mean, we have people from all over the world who are joining in our classes to understand, in many cases, how American philanthropy works and to see how it transitions in their own countries. We see people from Spain, from China, from Latin America, Canada, all over the globe taking classes, and it's quite wonderful to experience them, and they add so much to our understanding of nonprofit work. Cindy, you are actually a lawyer. I have a law degree. I wouldn't call myself a lawyer. But you actually practiced law and worked as a lawyer. How does one transition from the practice of law to the work of a nonprofit, or in this case, providing a vital piece of the nonprofit infrastructure as an educator?
I appreciate the question. It's not the first time or the 10th time that I've been asked this, actually. And I think there are two different areas that are, when I've done a lot of mentoring of younger people thinking about law school, that also have interest in mission-driven passions, I guess I should say. So one is the structural component. How do you think about moving as a lawyer who practices law into this space? And actually, there's a lot of law being practiced in this area. And I will talk about a little bit of how that happened for me, because, again, it was serendipitous, quite fortuitous, some of the opportunities I've had. But then there is the underlying why you even went to law school. For those people that went to law school thinking they actually did want to make a difference, they saw that law is a lever. For me, I was actually interested in law and policy at a very young age. I didn't know how to implement that. I grew up in a family of educators, which was great. My parents were both in higher education, both on the administrative side and on the teaching side. And so I grew up thinking about education always as a lever, but no one in my family was a lawyer. And I studied literature. I was a comparative literature major in college, studying the arts and languages, and knew that I wanted to teach at some point. But I found at the time that I wanted to do something more in the trenches. And I put myself through college and law school. And while I was working in college, I got my first, what I would consider, professional job, even though most people don't think about it that way. I was a resident assistant. And I started working at that time with a lot of different community needs, even though at the time I would not have articulated it that way. And I wound up working a lot with survivors of sexual assault. I worked with a lot of folks in the mental health community. Everything that our students deal with, we deal with when you work as a resident assistant and you're working with students. And I got deeper and deeper in that, and never forgetting that was in the context of higher education. And so I took a year and I worked as I decided what type of graduate program I wanted to go to. And in that year, I actually worked in higher education. I went to Indiana University, but I went to University of Michigan to work. I was married at the time, and we went to Ann Arbor, and I worked at U of M, and I started a career development office for a department. The reason I say this is that it all comes back 30-some years later, because here I am on a podcast talking about higher education, professionalization, and how we think about transitioning, or I don't even know that I consider it so much a transition as using your legal degree and your thinking that you learn as a lawyer. It really is true. You do learn to think like a lawyer in law school if you do it well, and utilizing those skill sets in a different context. And at that point, I decided to go to law school. And in law school, I founded a law journal, co-founded it with one of my colleagues, one of my peers. We founded a journal on women in the law. And then later in life, I wound up many, many years later, I've also founded a nonprofit legal clinic, which was to teach law students about how to think about nonprofit law and also serve as a legal services organization for nonprofits in many ways. I've also founded a medical clinic because I thought in our community, we needed a medical clinic for the uninsured. This was before the ACA, but it still exists today, long after the ACA has kicked in. So that was another way to think about how to utilize these skills, and especially governance skills, which you are very, very familiar with. And I also helped form and carry forward the National State Attorneys General program that dealt with a lot of policy issues. And now here we are with helping found the MSN nonprofit. So for me, I'm always trying to either help other people with a vision that they have to help solve a problem, or I myself have come up with something that's a gap filler that I believe is missing and that we need to get something off the ground. And I'm often quite happy to get something off the ground and hand it over to someone else. I feel strongly when you're working for community need, there's not a lot of room for proprietary interests. It's something that you need to be able to establish and decide if you're the person to keep running it or whether it's time for someone else's vision to also take over and to utilize other resources. And that's happened time and time again. And I'm good with that. Early on in my career, I decided I wanted to work in government for a while. And I did that. I was a chief counsel in a state attorney's general office, and I also then took the leap and went in to work with electeds and with politicians. And I did a lot of that as a volunteer on the policy side, helping with white papers and everything on the policy aspects. And so all of that came together for me. I was asked at one point if I would go be counsel to a national political convention, the Democratic convention, when Al Gore ran for president. And I did that. And then I did Kerry's years later. And in between, I worked on some regulatory legal issues and other in law firm and also some white collar working on ethics and compliance, believe it or not. This was when Sarbanes-Oxley was coming around. And all of that over time has led to this very interesting hybrid, as you would say, of a set of interests involving ethics, compliance, how we think about training people and educating people to utilize resources, and how to actually establish those resources when they don't already exist. Yeah. I have done a lot of those different kinds of things over the years. And that's, I guess, how I've transitioned. And I am still a member of Three Bars, so you're correct. I don't actually practice at the moment, but I definitely keep up my bar membership. And I do speak at different legal conferences because I think it's an important part of what I do.
Yeah, and you've recently written an amicus brief.
I was a co-author, correct, of the nonprofit scholars brief for the recent Supreme Court case.
What was that case about?
That was the state of California, and it was about disclosure laws for nonprofits and whether or not the state of California could require disclosure of certain cohort of donors, high-end donors within a nonprofit situation. And I and many other scholars, mostly legal scholars, of course, and they utilize some of the research that I've done over the years on state regulators, which has been my specific area of research, charitable regulatory policy, and specifically at the state level in particular. Although I've served on the IRS Exempt Organizations Advisory Committee, my work has mostly been with state regulators. And so that case was decided against the state of California, I might add. And so we will see where we go from there, because that's a real weighing of the issues of privacy versus transparency.
Yeah. Well, I'm exhausted. I need a nap just listening to all you've done over the years. It's quite amazing how many things you were involved in starting and founding and handing off and leading. It's quite remarkable that one person could do so much. One area I want to talk with you a little bit about, because I think it flows into what we're doing at Columbia, is the work you did with the state regulators. And how did that come about? What was the purpose of it? And I participated in a few of the meetings, the convenings that you've had over the years, and I always found them quite informative. But what was the genesis of that?
Well, I was in a state attorney's general office many years ago, as I said, and I've had the good fortune of going to a lot of the different meetings, particularly NAG, is what we call it, National Association of Attorneys General. And there were many trainings. And at the time, they did not have a specific training institute, which they do now within NAG. And it's actually amazing and quite well run, and hats off to them. But at the time, there was nothing around charities. And so later, when I worked with my dear and long-term colleague, Jim Tierney, who actually was a former AG and worked at Columbia Law School and was thinking about how to get this AG program off the ground. And he asked me, after I moved back to the Midwest, he actually asked me if I would come out to Columbia and help them. And so I did that on a pro bono basis for a while. And then I actually joined as a scholar, and then I joined as the ED and legal counsel in thinking through how to work with the National State Attorneys General program. We did not have an area of training around charities. And so I worked with the National Association of Attorneys General. Like, we collaborated on this. I would provide the content. We had some funding to do that through Ford Foundation, Mott Foundation, et cetera. And then NAG, as they're called, would actually help do some of the logistics. And we would come together and we would do these trainings constantly. And so over time, I realized that I needed some data. It was important to me that regulators understand our field of nonprofits, and they often come into this field through other means. They're coming in through consumer protection. They may come in even through the criminal side. They may be amazing litigators, but have no real sense of our sector. And so I saw a need that we needed to have the trainings, but later I saw a need that we actually needed some data on the regulators' offices, because I started going to academic conferences where I would sit through presentations of papers and they would talk about the state charities regulators, and never having talked to one, never having stepped foot in one of those offices. And it was concerning to me, to say the least. And so I started taking regulators to academic conferences through scholarships, and then I asked academics to come and talk with us as regulators, and then I started bringing practitioners in. And so for years, that's what I've been doing, is convening practitioners, policymakers, and academics to think together on some of our largest issues and to have a common vocabulary, if you will. And I found that we were missing some data, and that I just assumed it was out there. And when I went to find it, I couldn't. And so I decided we needed to have some research in this space. And I was lucky enough to have some funding. And I went to Urban Institute and I work with my good colleague, Elizabeth Boris and Mary Shelley, on trying to produce research. And now I have many other colleagues that are interested in this as well.
It's fabulous. Most people don't understand the role that attorneys generals and their colleagues play in regulating the nonprofit sector. But they play a key role in prosecuting fraud in our sector and making sure that charities are registered in their states to solicit. And, you know, even some charities don't know. I know I've come across lots of charities that don't register to solicit in their states, and they're out there raising money, probably illegally, and they don't realize it. So it's really important that these regulators get what they need to help us do what we need to do in our sector. And most people also don't understand that not a lot of resources are dedicated to this work in many states. So many offices operate with one or two attorneys, and they're supposed to cover the entire nonprofit landscape. So any assistance they can get is well appreciated, I'm sure. And I know that from talking to many of them myself, they certainly appreciated the work that you were doing. Cindy, but this crosses over into the area of ethics. And I know that ethics in the nonprofit sector is something that you value very highly. And it seems that ethics has taken a central point in the nonprofit management program at the School of Professional Studies. Am I right to say that this was high on your curriculum to produce, and why so?
I'm really glad you asked about this, because it's an absolute underpinning and is fundamental to all of the work that I've been doing. And that includes, I would say, the work at Columbia University, but it's not only at Columbia. You and I are collaborating right now on a book proposal and a hope-to-be book with two of our other colleagues, specifically around ethics in the nonprofit sector. And I'm surprised at times that we don't have more discussions about ethics in this sector. I think it's almost like people assume it's the what I call, you know, and others have called the white hat syndrome, that somehow we just must be doing good work because we're passionate about X or Y, even forgetting those actual fraudsters that are intent upon doing that. I'm talking about just average people trying to do good work in the sector. It's tough. Ethics can be tricky. There aren't a lot of answers at times. And one of the things that we're trying to do at the Columbia program, but certainly in other ways too, education comes in many, many forms. The program is one of them. The book, I hope, will be another. And the various times that I'm asked to speak on ethics to lots of different audiences, I think people are actually very interested in about it, but they don't actually know how to articulate a question at times. What's important is that there's an analysis that can be involved here, whether or not you think you've come to the quote, right answer. It stems in some ways from the same analysis that we think about in governance. And it ties back to the regulator question that you were asking. State regulators actually oversee most of governance, right? And they're not ethics police. But what they're interested in is to see if governance follows a process that makes sense. Even if it turns out what you as a board or you individually wind up doing didn't pan out, if you can show that you actually were thoughtful about it and trying to follow good stewardship of the resources that you've been granted to put back out into the community, that goes a long way. And it's similar with ethics. I would like to get to the point where we have ethics. I know it may sound mutually exclusive, but for example, in government, you are required to go through ethics trainings. As a lawyer, you are required to go through ethics trainings. Most large businesses and corporations now have some form, if they're large enough, have some form, even if it's just for risk management, that they have you go through ethics trainings. It seems to me that our sector, which is completely based on trust, certainly the Wise Giving Alliance has been the first to say, start with trust. This is something so fundamental to what we do. The word trust is actually baked into the vocabulary of charities for a reason. It is the essence of stewardship. And as you and I know, as we've had many discussions and as we teach our ethics class, both of us, there's a difference between legal compliance and ethics. We know that. I find that legal compliance, much as I've spent a lot of years on that, because I did work in political nonprofits. I've worked in higher education in this area. I've worked for for-profit businesses in dealing with ethics. I think we know that legal is just the basics. Then I would say you go up to what we have always considered best practices. But even that isn't ethics to me. Best practices also are what we consider a safe harbor at times, meaning if you just do what everybody else does, you're okay. When you put it that way, it sounds a little scary, doesn't it? Just doing what everybody else does is the old, you know, if they jump off a cliff, will you too? Ethics is higher than that. Ethics is something that rises above all of that and asks you to go through an analysis so that you can really think through the impacts of what you're about to do and whether you've conducted this analysis in a way that incorporates the views and the stakeholders' perspectives that ultimately will determine whether or not this was successful or not, the decision you're making. And that's, I think, where you and I have talked over the years, Art, and that we're thinking about in this book, how to give guidance to people about the how of thinking through it, not a specific answer.
Yeah, that's really key. And whenever we have a class, the students are always astonished by how the class unfolds and how their own views of the world and the nonprofit sector and their activities kind of flower. You know, it's quite remarkable to see how stunned they are at times at how they evolve from thinking one way when they start the class to thinking very differently at the end and the various scenarios that they go through. Ethics is key to our sector. And what we're finding, though, is education has its place, too. So this notion that, as I mentioned in the start, that we should be educating people to lead nonprofit organizations is still, in my opinion, relatively new. And I think that I've heard, anyway, that there's some conflict that people have in their minds about the relative importance of it. And I'll say, some people will say, for instance, we don't want a lot of, you know, data-driven people running organizations that are really based on the heart and based on our instincts to help and serve. Who needs that kind of education? What you're really trying to do is help people and move a cause forward. But we're also seeing that serious organizations understand that there is a profession involved in the management of nonprofit organizations. And to really achieve results takes more than just the heart. It takes, you know, real skills, real understanding of issues that nonprofits face, how best to collaborate with others, how to go about raising funds. Raising funds is more than simply, you know, going out and asking people for money. It's a whole process. So I think that this criticism deserves some attention. But yet we still need to balance it, right? So how do you balance this need for, you know, people who have a real heart for the work with this idea that people should also be skilled and educated?
So I am quite aware of the philosophical debate that you're referring to here. And I got to say, I understand it, but I come down solidly and will always come down solidly on the side of education. I think education is a lever, just like I've said, you know, the legal world is a lever. And I think education is just, and certainly formal education, is just one way for us to address ethics and the professionalization generally of the field. I have heard repeatedly how if you take the passion out of it, that somehow these are mutually exclusive, being able to be a good manager, being able to be a good steward, and be able to articulate why you're doing what you're doing, and also possibly even predicting certain outcomes, all of which is data-driven, right? That somehow that's mutually exclusive from having the passion and the mission at heart. I don't think they are. I don't think anybody seems to think that about professional chefs. We don't seem to have a problem with athletes who utilize data to get better. We're not advocating necessarily Moneyball for nonprofits, but it might not be a terrible idea. So I don't have an issue with this because I think that everyone that's in our sector, for the most part, you're there because you want to be. let's be real, you're probably not there for the pay, the average person that's working in a nonprofit. You're doing it for other reasons. So I think it's almost a given, but even if it's not, I think it's definitely there that you've got the mission. But to do the mission better, that's not a bad thing. We can't, in a time of scarce resources, with such magnificently huge community and social needs, not make the absolute best and most efficient use of those resources. And to me, being able to incorporate professional practices into a sector that deals with billions and billions of dollars every year, I don't see the problem. I think wedding those two worlds is not as difficult as people say. And as you and I have spoken about in the past, it's not only formal education. I think it's all sorts of ways that we can help educate leaders and managers and staff and donors and boards and beneficiaries about how this sector can function. And we're seeing new ways that it can function and new needs that we have with working with for-profit world and working with government in different ways. We need to be deployed in efficient ways. And we also need to be able to articulate what it is that we do. I teach a policy and advocacy class also. We have a communications requirement in our program for a reason. Because I think, and I'm not alone in this, that some of the problems we have in our sector is because people really, and policymakers, frankly, don't really understand what it is that we actually do. And it's one of the reasons we remain under-resourced often. It's one of the reasons I believe we have not had a federal office that really looks across government on behalf of the nonprofit sector and how it is we integrate with other aspects of government. I think there are myriad problems that come from the fact that we have not been an established field for more than 30 years academically, and we also have not had professional programs more than a handful across the country at the higher education level for master's degrees, certainly. We have a lot of certificate programs, and those are good too, can be good. But all of that adds up to being able to understand what it is we do and communicate it out so that we can be better at what we do.
Yeah. So, Cindy, one of the other underpinnings of our program is the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I want you to talk about how it plays such a center role in what we do and how we educate our students and how we teach them to interact and learn from each other. Also, we've been really active with our program to educate students from historically Black colleges and universities, and I would like you to talk about that program because I think it really does a great job in providing access to some students who might not otherwise be able to attend Columbia.
Sure. Well, we've had two major underpinnings of the entire curriculum, and also we have a mission statement at this program, and ethics and equity are two learning objectives that appear in all of our classes. It appears in our mission statement, it appears in the learning objectives of the program, and that is part and parcel of every single one of our courses, our electives, et cetera, the 20-some courses that we offer overall. As you've noted, Columbia, it's my understanding, is the number one university for international students in the sense that it's New York City, it's Columbia, only Ivy League in New York. We've got a lot of people from all over the world that want to come. But we also attract a lot of people domestically from all sorts of walks as well. Even if that were not true, we would still need both ethics and equity as fundamental to what it is that we do, particularly in this sector, in the nonprofit sector and in teaching in the nonprofit sector. It's also true for higher education generally. We live in a globalized world. We live in a differentiated world, and we're all in this together. And it's important that students, whether they have or have not been exposed to different perspectives and really thinking about where people are coming from and why those perspectives can be different. But we're all pulling, especially in our program, thinking about mission-driven organizations. It's really important that we try to open up those conversations and understand it. Our classrooms are safe spaces for people to speak, for people to, often it's through lived experience, but also their own beliefs that they have built up over the years. And part of higher education, whether you're 20 years old in college or whether you're 45 years old in our program, is to really help you think, dismantle and then build up again how you think about your work with community, particularly. So we do that in a lot of different ways. It's certainly, we hope, we're modeling that in our classrooms, of course. It's part of our learning objectives, as I said, for both individual courses and also for our program. And then we also do a whole series of workshops. We make sure that people understand in professional development settings how these issues may come to play. I mentioned before that one of the issues I have with best practices, where people want to go and kind of fall back on best practices, is that best practices in some ways help get us to some of the problems we have right now. It's not fair to say, well, we've done it this way for a long time, it must be okay. In fact, we're seeing the very disruption of that now, and so we should. And so we take them very, very seriously. Now, the HBCU program is not one that we initially started. That was actually done at the School of Professional Studies with a number of master's degree programs. But what happened at the beginning is that more HBCU fellows chose our program. It's a fellowship program where they can apply. Their schools actually nominate them. They're undergraduate HBCUs. They nominate them. The students apply to a program. We have to accept them as leaders of that program, and then they can also be chosen as an HBCU fellow. More of them chose the nonprofit management program at the time than others. Now this program has been so successful, they've expanded it to all of the programs at all 16, I believe, at the School of Professional Studies. And it's been tremendous for us. We take very seriously that these students have come up through a system that has really help them with their lived experience and also think through what that means for them as they're giving back to communities and also to reach their own professional and career goals. And so by the time they graduate from our program, they may be all of 22 and they now have a master's degree from Columbia in addition to their HBCU undergraduate degree. And they're very, very good about reaching back and helping other HBCU fellows. And I know you are, I want to thank you because I know that you've done a lot of outreach to our students and other HBCU students to help them think through next steps in their careers. And it's tremendous work and it's needed work.
Well, I learned so much from them. People talk about mentoring and it is our responsibility as sort of elders to mentor those coming along. But I learned so much. I believe in reverse mentoring. And so my mentoring them is somewhat selfish because I get so much in return, something for others of my generation to think about. And not only my generation, I mean, I think we can start mentoring at really early ages. You know, if you're 20, you can mentor someone who's 16. If you're 16, you might be able to mentor someone who's 62. So mentoring is something that we all can use and benefit from. So, Cindy, not everybody is going to be able to get an education at Columbia School of Professional Studies. But yet, I think education, as you mentioned, and I certainly agree, is really important. So what are some of the other approaches that people can take to getting educated and being prepared for a life of service and giving and also of providing the kind of leadership in both their organizations and the sector?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing to be at such a wonderful, fantastic private university in New York City, but that is a far cry from certainly where I grew up in the Midwest. I was a public school person. My parents were public school folks as educators for the most part. And so I take it very seriously that we have to think about not just even in the formal education channels, but outside of that, whether you're a leader or whether you're much younger. One thing I will say is that my children are now 19, 22, but when they were in school, I was always impressed that there were groups trying to teach young people about service. Apart from religious organizations that often do that as well, I could see that in K through 12 public schools, there were actually a number of opportunities to really start that process and thinking with students, you know, this should be part of life. It certainly was in my family. My parents volunteered in the community all the time, and I had that modeled for me at a very young age, and I took it very seriously as well. And I was grateful and remain grateful for that. But not everybody has the luxury of being able to do that. So I think that if you are in education already, there are many, many places as a student you can go and find many outlets. And lots of undergraduate educational institutions now have something on nonprofits or service. So that's another thing that's happened in the last decade, I would say. If you are already in the nonprofit sector, or if you are thinking about making the transition, which is also a group of folks that I talk a lot to, is how they're thinking about taking the skills they've worked for in the for-profit world, and they're now moving and wanting a life change and moving into a day job, if you will, that involves nonprofits or service. There are many, many community organizations that hold trainings and workshops. Certainly United Way does that, many community foundations. Lots of universities actually do open up, as we do. We open up certain trainings for public consumption, either free or very, very cheap. So there are, I think, community-based resources that people can go to. One of the other things, one of the other levers that I'm always looking for the levers here, is that I have really spoken with a number of professional organizations, say at the state level, the state CPA organization, that says if you're not offering those trainings to your communities, you should be thinking about that. You're sitting on a lot of institutional and amazing sophisticated knowledge that people need in your community, and they can't afford to hire you, but they could at least start getting their toe in that water if they had your resources, you know, through a series of workshops, et cetera. And so finding those, you know, whether it's financial, it's fundraising, it's management, it's communications, and saying, where are the professional organizations that could also be offering those resources and trainings in the community for free or very low rates is also important if you're a seated professional already.
Yeah. I remember years ago when I started out my career in public accounting, I joined an organization called Community Accountants. And actually, it was through Community Accountants that I had my first assignment working to assist a nonprofit with their record keeping and supporting their manager. It was a small nonprofit, and they didn't know a whole lot about record keeping and financial management. And through that experience, they were able to build up some knowledge of that. So you're right. I think all professional organizations that have these tools and this knowledge can devolve some of it to organizations, and I think it would be a great service. So Cindy, as we get toward the end of this interview, I want to ask you to kind of look out maybe another 10 years or so and give me your sense of our sector and what education will mean to it and what we may see. You know, we're already seeing some transition from in-person to virtual learning. And by the way, we were virtual long before COVID. That was really fortuitous, right? And we were sitting in different places, having classes and meeting with students around the world. But what do you see for nonprofit education specifically, but maybe education more generally? I think we're certainly recognizing that it's expensive. We're recognizing that while it is expensive, we can't necessarily do without it. So how do we rationalize maybe the business model? How do we recruit the best students? How do we create access? You know, so these are some of the big questions I think that colleges and programs are wrestling with now. What are you seeing and what are you hoping for, I guess, over the next decade or so?
Well, that's a really big question. Yeah. If you're looking especially at education writ large. I was just in my policy class mentioning this last night, that first you have to decide what's the problem you're solving for. And we often, especially in our sector, we're thinking, okay, access issues to higher education or certain types of outcomes, et cetera. But it's all connected. The ultimate outcome is that we have stronger societies, that we have more inclusive societies, that we have more equity in our societies. And so one thing I think is all the longitudinal studies absolutely showing that education matters to people. it matters for their economics. It matters for, you know, all sorts of socioeconomic issues, but it also matters in terms of personal fulfillment and happiness. That's not selfish, right? If you go through education, you hope that there are some outcomes like that on the other side. We hope that it involves democracy, strengthening society in a pluralistic sense. We hope in a globalized society that's connected by technology more than ever and will only continue to be so, that we have better understandings of the world that we sit in. We need those studies. This is where research comes in handy. We need those studies that show when people have access to education, they have better outcomes, and society has better outcomes as a result. We were, as you noted, online even before the pandemic at our program. I will tell you that even back in college, I left school after 3 years on campus because I was almost done at 3 years, and I had a couple few courses that I did. And back then it was correspondence, right? You know, you stick your, write it out, put it in an envelope, and like, you know, it was like putting a message in a bottle, and you wondered when you'd get your grade back. I had a couple of those courses because I didn't need to be on campus for those couple of courses. They were fine being done that way. We've had a long history in education of distance learning in some form. And I, at this point, because technology is shortening our distances, I think we are only more so headed in that direction. Now, there will always be a place. Absolutely. Campus is an amazing experience. I was there yesterday, and the puzzle and the hustle of all of it is astounding. And it's a collective intellectual hive. There is no replacing certain aspects of that. But there are specific areas, back to our conversation of professionalization, even in the nonprofit field, there are certain areas that we really do actually want people to have access to information and learn, no matter where they sit in the country, no matter how big or small their community is, no matter how many resources they have to devote to education, whether they're in an organization or in their own family budget. We want that to happen. And I think the democratization of that, you know, is and should be continuing due to technology and due to the fact that we need more and more to document the need for this.
Yeah. Well, Cindy, I can't thank you enough for spending this time with me and sharing your life, your career, your work, your love, your passion with me and all of our listeners. And obviously, I am just delighted to call you a friend and to have worked with you these many years. And I just know that you're going to be doing more great things both at Columbia and outside. And people should pay really close attention to Cindy Lott. Find ways to support and connect her. You've heard all the amazing things that she's done throughout her life. And I bet there are about a dozen more things that she's going to do at least before she's through.
I hope so. Well, I thank you so much, Art. You know that it has been such an honor to work with you and to be a friend of yours for all these years. You have had such a long and deep history and also thinking about all these issues in so many different ways and entry points. And I can't thank you enough for that personally, but also as a member of this sector and mission-based organizations, we have you to thank for a whole lot. So thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll listen to other episodes by just going to any of the major podcast platforms. You can also follow us and subscribe on Patreon if you want to make a donation, patreon.com. And also make a comment on, especially on Apple Podcasts. We would love to get a favorable review on Apple Podcasts because that helps us to build audience. Thank you very much.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.